The following is an interview with Lee A. Nunn, N-U-N-N, White House Fellow and Executive Assistant to William Timmons. The interview was conducted by Susan Yowell on August 16, 1973, in Mr. Nunn's office in the East Wing of the White House. There have been, starting with the Truman Library, there have been fairly extensive oral history projects covering the administration. And we are very fortunate at this point to be able to do this background now because it's so much easier to get the people while they're here.
Right.
And also I found that it's a little bit helpful to at least gloss over everything, because it's amazing what people forget even in just a few years.
Right.
And probably would not get back to people until sometime after he leaves office, and possibly long time after that, depending on what the library staff and the Nixon Foundation and whatever happens with the oral history project. So.
Well, what would you think the best approach? First, to go down and sort of describe the job?
Yeah, that's really what we're looking for. And first of all, I should mention to you that we're taping these. At first, we weren't even taping these.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work because Terry Good nor I are very good at taking fast notes. And then for a while, because of our lack of clerical staff, we were trying to write narrative summaries rather than full transcriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that that, too, was not very workable because it really almost takes longer to sort it all out and boil it down to two or three pages in a narrative summary, and we would find that we would put more emphasis on something than maybe the person being interviewed would prefer. So we are planning on transcribing all of these completely, and it will take time because we don't have the staff to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
We've done maybe a dozen or so. And we would send you a copy of the draft for your editing before it would be released. They are being considered as presidential property, just like any other presidential papers. And for that reason, they wouldn't be open to researchers until sometime after Nixon Library is established. And of course, we'll then go through a normal screening process. Although, again, we're not really trying to go into anything which might be particularly sensitive now, just because we're not going into that much depth right now.
Okay. Well, why don't I just give you a brief rundown of how I came on and who I replaced and how the job developed since I've been here. I came on the job while most of the people were down at the convention in Miami in the last week of August. I was brought on board to replace Bud McFarlane, who was a White House fellow and who held the job as executive assistant to Bill Timmons before I did. Now, Bud remained in the job over there until Congress adjourned about November 1st. And during that time, I worked over here in the East Wing in this office with the people that work up on the Hill. We had two Senate people, Tom Corlogus and Wally Johnson, that worked the Senate side, and two House people at that time, Dick Cook and Max Friedersdorf. Also, John Niedecker was here during that time frame and handled special projects. Well, by November, I knew pretty much how those people operated, how they handled the relations between the White House and the Hill, how they answered the correspondence, and I knew their techniques, the differences and idiosyncrasies between the Senate and the House, who the important people were, and also knew the sorts of specialty areas that each of these individuals had in addition to working with just the House and just the Senate. Now, each morning, Bill holds an 8 o'clock staff meeting over in his West Wing office. And of course, I attended those with everyone else from these offices. And from that, was able to learn pretty much what was going on over in the West Wing office in addition to what we were doing. And occasionally, they would give me a special project to work on, which primarily consisted of making a summary of what the accomplishments were during the second session of the 92nd Congress. What our victories were, what our defeats were, what our sort of tabulating who were our key supporters, who had changed significantly from a supporter to someone who voted with us very little. And then on November 1st, I went over to the West Wing. Bud McFarland was leaving at that point in time to go back to work with the Marines. And I worked a couple weeks there with him around so that I could find out exactly what Timmy's modus operandi was. And then I undertook a full-time job over in that office. As it happened, I was able to keep this office, and it was useful because I have three gals that work over here in the secretariat, headed up by Eloise Frayer. They work for me and answer all the presidential mail that we receive from the Congress to the President. And I was able to read, review, and check the where the blind courtesy copies were sent and who had the action for these things each morning, and I'd come back usually during my lunch hour and eat lunch here and check again. Before I went home, I would usually work over here and keep up with the things that were going on. And this aided in my transition. And I maintained this office, I guess, through February. And at that time, I pretty much had to work full-time over there with Timmons. We lost some people. Wally Johnson went to Justice, Dick Cook went to work for Lockheed, and we were down to one man in the Senate and one in the House, which is an unbearable burden. The executive assistant position over in the West Wing with Timmons is primarily one in which you try to free him up as much as possible from the many calls and the many less important letters and bits and pieces of paper that come in his office, staff action memorandum, and so on. And either reduce it to a very concise statement, a little memo slip for him to look at and initial off of, or take care of it yourself entirely and really let him know what you have done, what you initialed off, just passing him a note saying that I signed off on this and for you, seemed to be no problem. I checked beforehand with people in the East Wing. So, there are innumerable calls that come in over there, people that want to talk to him. Of course, if he took them all, he'd get nothing done. And so I gradually worked into the position where the people would talk to me, and I became an acceptable voice and name for the congressmen and senators. Not always. Occasionally got chewed out. But the idea was that I would try to reduce some of the burden on Bill's shoulders, thereby making him more available to handle the more important things, to be available to go in and see the President on short notice when he needed to get the key problems taken care of. Of course, the job of getting the President's program through the Congress and working with a co-equal body of our federal government is possibly the most important job here in the White House, certainly in the domestic arena. It is extraordinarily important. The office, the position there also amounted to somewhat of a clearinghouse for information for other agencies. If somebody in the domestic council or OMB wanted to know what the last moment sort of situation was up on the hill, why, they could check with me and find out. I could then go to our people here that were working the hill and find out whether the bill in its present form was in accord with the president's desires or whether it was something that was objectionable, and perhaps be able to say what we would require to have be amended before we would find it acceptable. And so between the people here that worked the hill telling Bill and myself in the morning what was going on up there and people asking questions, we developed a knowledge of the status of the particular piece of legislation at a given moment in time. It changes, you know, something you're for in the morning at 10 o'clock, at 10:05 may be amended to where it's totally objectionable. And you need to keep ahead of those things so you can give signals to our supporters on the Hill as to what the President's position is, and ask them to stick with the President on this issue or that. There's one other responsibility over there other than the normal executive assistant type duties which you perform, and that was that I was the individual who sat in for Bill and all members of the Property Review Committee. And this committee was a second level staff meeting which took the place of regular meetings of the Property Review Board. The Property Review Board itself, which Timmons was a member and the director of OMB is a member, would normally not meet unless there were a crucial action involving disposal of some property or designation of some piece of property for the Legacy of Parks program. And I would sit in on those meetings with people from OMB and from GSA and from the Property Review Board, and we would evaluate the pros and cons and hear the views of defense and NASA and whoever else was involved in the VA, whoever else was involved in disposing of property. Then, more recently, that Property Review Board has evolved to where it has been totally replaced by the Federal Property Council. And in the course of preparing the executive order, which established the Federal Property Council and revoked the one which established the Property Review Board, why, I worked very closely with Ann Armstrong and her staff in an effort to put together something which would allow the White House to control policy, at the same time not get involved in the minutia or the day-to-day administration of disposing or acquiring federal property. It's one thing the President had identified as an issue, and we felt the federal government, of course, owned too much property and we ought to dispose of it if we don't need it. And he also pushed the Legacy of Parks program. And these Property Review Board and Federal Property Council were the mechanisms for doing that. So I worked very closely with those bodies and spoke on behalf of Timmons. Usually, if I had an important meeting, I'd tell him what was being done, what I thought we ought to do. We'd discuss it and the decision would be made, and I could speak on his behalf. The reason we're involved in that is because of the fact that if you're going to dispose of a piece of property that's a picnic area or a buffer zone in the VA hospital, you can generate quite a bit of congressional flack or irritation if they are not notified, if they disagree with the decision, if the local populace gets up in arms about it. And in order to try to circumvent that by keeping people advised and
shut the door, I think the typewriter will pick up on that and we'll talk about it. be able to hear it.
The Armed Services Committee may take exception to some action in disposing defense property. And we cleared through them beforehand. The VA and the members of the committee that the veterans committee that's in charge of veteran affairs would want to know what we were doing, being kept advised, as well as the congressman in whose district the piece of property might be located. So we did not want bureaucrats at GSA or anywhere else preemptorily doing these things without taking account and letting the White House ensure that they weren't cutting off the nose to spite their face by establishing a park, but in the meantime making enemies, losing votes up on the hill, which we didn't want to do. And I think it was very successful. I think the property council is a good improvement over the property review board. I think we have the situation organized now just the way we want it. The GSA will be responsive to the White House, and I think the lines of authority are very clearly established. That's about the only thing, I guess, that I could point to as a special project. That was involved at least one meeting a week, and then a good bit of work over and above the normal congressional relations type work. There's, I guess, not much point in going into what an executive assistant does. It's almost a self-descriptive title.
When you were applying for the White House Fellows Program, were you applying for that specific position?
No. First, you have to be selected as a fellow. Then you can work. If you desire, you list four or five agencies you'd like to interview with, and you can select agencies based on areas where you can use your particular knowledge, background, and expertise, or as in my case, you can select an area where you'd like to broaden yourself. And, since I had primarily been involved in affairs which were international in scope rather than domestic, I decided that I would like to work in the domestic arena and get an idea of how the White House and the departments interrelate with Congress. I think that once I began to interview, it became apparent to me that the job in congressional relations was the best of the lot. Now, I don't say that in a bragging way, but for me, an opportunity to work very closely with the senior staff, which Timmons is a member, and to at the same time learn a great deal about the Congress, which is a co-equal body, and they don't let you forget it. I felt that I would learn the maximum amount about the problems that the executive branch has. There's some disadvantages, and you don't get to follow a program such as you might in HUD or HEW, but on the other hand, you do get to see the crunch issues of legislation debated and argued and fought out between the various departments and their committees, and then between the President and the Congress, and you see the compromise effect that must take place in order to get something, and you see where things will go to the limit such that the President must veto it. And you see calls made where it's very difficult to decide whether or not to veto it, veto a bill. And this particular position, to my way of thinking, gave me all the education, background, experience that I could possibly want to see in this year. I interviewed domestic counsel. They did not take a fellow. I was interested in working there primarily because of Mr. Ehrlichman's presence. I met him, been introduced, heard him speak, thought he was a very incisive individual. I thought that the domestic council had tied together a great deal of the rather lax control between the White House and the cabinet departments, and I was very interested in a organization such as the domestic council, which was oriented on issues, domestic issues, identifying them. Something like revenue sharing, which is a presidential issue, or something like drug usage in the United States, which was an issue which existed much like crime or anything else without the president's taking the initiative to generate that issue. As it turned out, they were reducing the size of the domestic council, and they knew that at the time I interviewed. They were going to cut it back right after the election, reduce the size of the White House staff. So they were not interested at that point in time in bringing on another White House fellow. They have two White House fellow, former fellows that are now associate directors over there, Dana Mead and Jeff Shepard. And I interviewed with Dana and just talked to Jeff briefly, and they were very high on the job and the council, but they were also aware that there wasn't much likelihood. I interviewed at Interior and Labor. I think those were the only other places. And interviewed with Timmons, and of course, as I found out what Timmons was involved in, what level of staff individual he was, what sort of relationships I would have with him, and how I would relate to the other senior staff, and the fact that I would have a chance to work on this side to learn something about the Hill before I went over to his office made it look as if it were just ideally laid out. So often you come into a job and you're either handed something the first day, which is not good if you have no expertise in the area, and I do not. My family has been involved in politics for years, but I've never had an occasion to spend even a week with any of them when they were involved in such politics. And so I was very inexperienced, if not naive. But I will say one thing about Timmons. He's been here since the beginning. He's worked under Harlow and McGregor. He is a low-profile sort of individual, very knowledgeable politically. Certainly when Alderman Ehrlichman left, there was no one other than the president in the West Wing of the White House that could measure up to his ability and skill. And of course, with the type of things and the flow of things through Haig's office, he came up to speed very quickly, but he relied on Timmons. And National Security Council, where Haig came from, was relatively unpolitical. It was operating in a more ethereal environment than you do in domestic politics. There's not so many experts on the Hill in international affairs, but when it comes to domestic affairs, there's chairman of powerful committees and every member that is an expert, and you really have to be quite capable politically to deal in that sort of environment, and Timmons is. So my education under him was an extraordinary thing, an extraordinary asset, I feel. He has so many times been able to tell me, you know, what you should do and what you shouldn't do and why, and he does it in a very tactful way. He'll say, well, I don't think that's the right thing. I mean, do you? If you say that or do this, why, they'll come back. And unless you have very persuasive arguments for what you've done, he, in a few moments, has quickly brought to your attention two things that make it seem as if what you've done is wrong and should be turned around. But he's not overbearing you. Offensive. Sometimes he does get a little excited. Extraordinarily fine man to work for. I have the very highest regard for him. Regrettably, there's not a White House fellow coming on to replace me. Pat O'Donnell's taking the job over there now. This is by mutual agreement. I felt very badly about having to leave in February for a 3-week trip to Russia, and again last month for a 3.5-week to China. An executive assistant can't do that. Timmons should not ever have to pick up his own phone. He gets trapped so often with somebody who will take up a lot of his time or try to get him committed to something and just be very selfish about dragging Timmons over old material. Timmons has handled the subject and doesn't care to talk to the individual further on it, or would like to have somebody else call him and get Timmons off the hook. He ought to be able to do that, but he picks up the phone and catches the individual himself. Those things can happen. Of course, he handles himself beautifully, but I think it is a waste of his time. It's a bad situation if you have problem people trying to use you and have access through you. And Timmons comes in early and leaves very late at night, and particularly late at night if the gals have gone. The executive assistant ought to be there to try to help in those situations. So I felt bad about being away, and just about the time I'd be handling his personnel matters, we have a lot of patronage requests from the Hill, and the Hill wants a nice letter back that they can send to the constituent or whoever it is that's recommending some individual, and they'd also like the follow-ups on it. Well, I normally have about 300 or 400 personnel items that I'm following up for Timmons, and that's a major responsibility, and consequently I get a lot of calls back in. And if Timmons gets the calls himself, he'd get tied up in the personnel business exclusively, and some congressmen feel it's fine to deal with Jerry Jones, Fred Malik, whoever's over in the personal office. But they like to reinforce it with a call to Timmons because he's congressional relations and he'll make sure that the Congress is given full consideration. And so they will call him incessantly. That's what it is. Or other projects. We also track a lot of HUD, EPA, and other agency projects, EDA projects that people were very concerned about. That took up a lot of my time that he should not be involved in. Now, in my absence, if good Mr. Passman calls in and would like to know about a HUD project down in Monroe, Louisiana, if Timmons has to stop and make the calls, or ask one of the secretaries to make the calls, it usually is not justified. Mm-hmm. It takes too much of his time. The secretary may take two calls away and do it in one. So I felt that a fellow was not really the best thing for that job. You ought to have a permanent individual, because an individual that works over there on a full-time basis and is not sort of obligated to partake in these other educational requirements that the fellows have can be responsive to Timmons' needs to an even greater extent than a fellow can. And he will probably come over to this wing to work when he leaves that job, so whoever the replacement might be will have constant access to his predecessor. And with White House fellow, that may not be true. The old fellow may leave when you're in September, and the new fellow come in September, and it's a relearning process that's very inefficient.
This is something I've talked with several of the fellows. One from last year's program, it was saying just what you are, mm-hmm. that feeling guilty about leaving on the trips or about the other educational programs that are set up for the fellows. Do you think that this year's program was, what I understood last year's program was, really focusing on the opportunities for the fellows rather than on a particular job?
Well, I do think two trips around the world of 3.5 weeks duration is too much, unless you can. If I could have done this trip exclusively during the time Congress was in recess in August, which is right at the end of your fellow's year, but if that could have been done, then I wouldn't have felt too bad about it. Or if I could have done it during Christmas vacation somewhere in there, I wouldn't have felt too bad about it. Or if the trips had been a week or so, a week or 10 days, go take a very intense look at a country and come back. But the trips were put together to go through a series of countries, and I think that that was a mistake, because the job is, in my case anyway, the most important thing. And probably half the fellows have jobs that require their presence, jobs that keep them very busy, and bosses who use them very well. The other half may be in positions which there's a great deal more flexibility about when they're going to hang on this one. And I suppose, well, I did offer to cancel out on both of them, and Timmons, I think, very unanimously said that, you know, it's a chance of a lifetime to go to Russia and to China too. You shouldn't pass it up. We'll try to hang on where you're going, which is flattering remark about what I was doing, but it is a question. There are about 5 or 6 domestic trips too, where you go to Boston or Atlanta and study the urban crisis in New York and Montreal and those sorts of things. And those are much more appropriate. The fellows program perhaps is trying to do too much if they try to place you in a very substantive job. If you have a very substantive job, then your education program is going to hurt. I guess I didn't go to many more than half of the educational luncheons, breakfast, dinners that the fellows offered because of my job. We have breakfast with Dan Rather, and lunch with Walter Washington, and supper with Elliot Richardson, and lunch with Thurgood Marshall, and Armstrong. These are key individuals, and I wanted to talk to them and have a good question and answer session. They did. But I sort of had to pick and choose as to which of those I could afford to be away, depending on time, length, what was going on. Very often, we have something hot going on in my office, and even though I'd said I'd go, I just canceled out and didn't go.
But it was left pretty much up to the individual fellow as to where he wanted to put the emphasis.
Right. I guess we could have. I think if the trip, for instance, had been anywhere other than Russia and China, I would not have gone. I would not have gone to Eastern Europe, and there were some questions whether the military were going to be allowed access into Russia. They were not the last time the fellows went. And until I was as certain of that fact, why I was not planning on going on the Russian trip.
You are a major in the Air Force.
Lieutenant Colonel in the Army. I came from the Air Force Academy and was teaching physics out there when I was selected. But I was on there as an exchange officer. And then came here directly from the Air Force Academy. A lot of people had it mixed up, even the Air Force Academy. Thought that one of their officers, Air Force officers, had been picked and found out it was an Army officer. That is an interesting sort of thing. Probably should be mentioned too, especially in light of some of the recent criticism involving Dana Mead. Once I came to work, I strictly used the title Mr. rather than Major or Lieutenant Colonel. I didn't do that in order to cover up anything, but I did it in order not to irritate anybody or raise any hackles or make myself less effective for Timmons. I certainly never had an occasion to ask anybody for their vote on an issue one way or the other. And of course, by law, being in the military, I'm precluded from doing that under the Hatch Act. And so there was no question that I would never be involved in those sorts of things. And of course, this was spelled out by Timmons when I first came to work. But on the other hand, if anyone asked whether I was in the military, I said yes, I was here for 1 year as a fellow, would be returning. I never had any problem with it. I don't think until very recently that most of the people in the West Wing realized that I was military. I was able to see a great deal of what goes into decision making within the White House. And I was able to see the influence of politics on the decision. And not only that, to see the importance of it, the crucial nature of political considerations. And I would be much more able to comprehend why a decision was made or why it went this way or that way, regardless of the merits of the individual arguments. Because I think at this point in time, I can now evaluate some of the political considerations and can judge better what things drive the federal government and the executive branch and Congress. I think that's I think it's unfortunate that the military would be excluded from witnessing that and becoming knowledgeable in that area. We have a tradition, of course, of not being involved in partisan politics in the military. We take great pride in that, and the country is very proud that their military is not politically oriented and is not involved in any sort of pressure politics within the federal branch of the government. On the other hand, that may be carried too far if you preclude the military from doing these sorts of things, such as taking fellowships or doing an internship or an exchange officer program, where they can learn what their civilian contemporaries are doing and how they operate and what the constraints are that they must deal with and how important the Congress and the political considerations are and what is regarded highly within the political arena as being good and bad, because it's a whole different set of criteria. And certainly as valid as a criteria that's good and bad within the military, except when the two are taken out of context, very often there's misunderstanding. And I think that I can carry a lot of water over in the Defense Department now in their relations with the executive branch or with Congress, regardless of the administration, based on my experience here. I think that I have seen a number of instances where my contemporaries have not been able to fully appreciate the importance of these sorts of things and have acted incorrectly in some cases or gotten themselves in trouble because of their lack of what I would call political expertise or awareness. Now, we certainly wouldn't want to deal in the military with, on a political basis. You're getting all sorts of trouble if you back and fill and waffle on subjects. So when you're dealing with the military, people want to know yes or no. We're going to go or we're not going to go, and we're going to do it right or we're not going to do it at all, and that sort of thing. You don't like the ifs, things, and buts, and maybes. In the political world, if you come out with such a fixed position or such a ironclad goal, such a rigid definition, use of words, you might get yourself in a corner that you could never get out of. And that's not to say that you want to you wish to make it appear that you know, politicians weasel word all their statements so they have an out. But you do want to be aware that the politician, politics by definition is the art of compromise. And so consequently, they must position themselves so that if powers on the other side of the aisle are such that they must compromise, that they have not put themselves in a public position where they cannot yield, where they cannot bow to a greater influence or a greater ideal or a stronger backing than they have for their issue. Their issue may not be the issue of the moment. So, anyway, that's just a little discourse in some of my philosophical observations about the military working in these positions. I think that the director of the White House Fellows Commission was a little concerned about placing a military man in my position next year because of the sensitivity of it. But Bud McFarland, my predecessor, was a major in the Marines, and I think neither one of us had an occasion to get in any difficulty because of our being in the military. We caused no problems. The military is attractive, I think, to people in the White House because they recognize the importance of loyalty. And this is not loyalty where you salute and say yes, sir, and do whatever you're told. But it's loyalty and reliability. They know, Timmons, I think, gave me opportunity to observe and witness everything that went in and out of his office, practically. And when he's talking to members of his staff, I could even listen in on the phone. So he didn't cover up anything. He always allowed me in the office, regardless of who was there, to pop in and to hear things, particularly if it was somebody that was very important and be educational to hear. By virtue of his doing that, I knew immediately that I had an obligation to not reiterate what I'd heard to the press, or even in some cases to my wife. I do not talk about what I've been privileged to witness or see, not in the interest of covering up, but in being aware that it was a private conversation or situation, and it was not my place to say anything or comment on it one way or the other. That access was a privilege, and one which I felt that I must respect by being very discreet about what I said or what I mentioned about what I'd seen or heard within the White House, I think. On the other hand, some fellows come in, they're a bright, articulate group of people, perhaps authors, writers, have ideas of their own, and they come in and they would probably like to write a book. I would too, and someday I may, but not until the time is appropriate, not without respecting the loyalty that was shown me by perhaps giving the people I worked with an idea, a chance to look at it. So, this idea of loyalty is a question which has never been fully understood by people outside the White House. Very, very important to the president. You're on his team. I regard myself as working for the man down the hall in the Oval Office. And I do whatever I can to make him more effective. The military, you do the same sort of thing. You may be working for somebody who's not doing things as you would do. He may not be even competent in your view. But the point is, he's there, and if you're one of his assistants or staff officers, you have an obligation, I think, to identify his weak areas, and if that's something where you can affect by filling in for him, you ought to do it. Because if you don't, other people get hurt. And in the military, it's very serious. You die. You get killed. Planes crash. There's terrible things can occur. So it's not good to backbite and second guess and talk from hindsight about what should have been done and this and that and the other thing. You may personally not agree. You may personally do it differently if you have the chance. But while you're there, you, I think, have an obligation to make that man as effective as he can for the good of the organization. I think for the good of the country, people in the White House have an obligation to make the president as effective as they can. I think the people in the country like very much to look up to the White House, and they like to think that the finished copy that comes out of here is very good. And we ought to polish things and send them out here looking very good, something that people can look up to and respect and admire. And that is not of the nature of a cover-up. Sure, if you look behind the scenes, you find that things aren't perfect, people aren't perfect. It's no great discovery, you aren't anywhere. But we ought to be trying harder, working longer, and doing a better job of it, or we ought to be replaced here in the White House. And the contention that this sort of loyalty and this sort of effort is damaging to the institution or to the public because it doesn't give them a clear picture. I don't think the public wants or needs a totally clear picture of what goes in here. I don't think they want foreign governments or anyone else to have a totally clear picture of what goes in here. Someday, yes, maybe it will. But while we're here, there are certain things that are done, certain things that are not done. Loyalty is a really important part of the equation. I think that's why the military has been attracted to it. I think that civilians feel that they know that the military has a good comprehension of that particular principle and that they can rely on it.
I know that the White House
Spouse
Program is supposed to be a nonpartisan program.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it is?
Yes.
Or, again, do you think it can be?
I think it can be. We had 6 Democrats, 6 Republicans, and 5 Independents in my class. And I think that the next class that's been selected is about the same. We might not... of course, there are presidential appointees that are making the selection, and they might be less apt to be able to go along with somebody who's terribly bright, but also a little bit weird in his dress or his mannerisms. That to me is not so much because, it's not at all because of his politics. They don't ask about the politics. There's sort of an informal poll taken after the selection by the commission director, just for curiosity. But the commission in evaluating an individual may take exception to his dress and mannerisms and other things during the personal interviews because they're aware that that fellow is going to work for a cabinet officer, cabinet level officer within the government. He ought to fit in. That doesn't mean that we want to jack him into a certain mold and make everybody wear pinstripe suits and short haircuts. But he ought to be able to fit in without being ostentatious or showy. He shouldn't draw attention to himself. He ought to be low-key. We certainly have, year before my year, there was a White House fellow that was an Indian. And I think he wore an earring in his ear and had long hair. In my class, we have a fellow working over at HEW that wears his hair fairly long, but these individuals are in no way trying to draw attention to themselves. In no way are they apt to reflect unfavorably on their boss. We have a very fine black that worked for Secretary Butts in my class. He's been asked to stay on as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. And he will do a very fine job. Now, I guess that particular individual's politics and his family were always Democratic. I can't imagine a black from South Carolina that would not be. But he's a very fine individual. Butts is, of course, very straightforward, nothing funny about him. He judges somebody on their merits. He liked this individual very much, and they worked closely together during the election. So he's continuing on. I think would be a great asset to the administration. Most effective black spokesman. But that individual would not have been able to be effective over in agriculture, working with a conservative man like Mr. Butts, if he had come in very flashily dressed, you know, white shoes, high heels, an outdoor haircut. The administration would not, I think, undertake to critically comment on people's dress and grooming But I think that the commission must select people who will fit in without causing the consternation or without, you know, being hard to place with cabinet level officers. In all that discussion, in no time we bring up the subject of politics. I don't think anybody really cares. For instance, Bud McFarland, who's my replacement, who I replaced, was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And he's working with Timmons in one of the most sensitive offices within the White House. I happen to be a Republican and probably more conservative than most Republicans. Probably more conservative than the president, but I don't, you know, that came from family experience, as do most people's politics, I think. According to Dick Scammon, that's the dominant thing, not your age or your skin color or anything like that.
To go back just for one minor thing, you said that when you first came, you were over here and supervising the correspondence section.
Well, I continue to supervise them in both when I worked in the West Wing and the East Wing. The White House Fellow, or Timmons' executive assistant, as it now is, either one, has responsibility for supervising the Secretariat. The Secretariat's three girls, Eloise Freyer, who's been here for years, and is a GS-12 or above equivalent, and Virginia Olson is an 11 or above, and one other girl, Jan Kogut, who's GS-7 or 8. Now these girls know exactly when a letter comes in, the type of response that is needed, the speed with which we must respond. We try to respond within 48 hours. We try to give a substantive reply within 48 hours to the congressman or senator. If we cannot, we'll give them an acknowledgement and ask Interior, Domestic Council, National Security Council to give a substantive reply. And then we follow up on that. There are a lot of minor requests for birthday greetings or pictures. That's handled very routinely by the youngest of the gals in there. And the crucial things, we may have to draft a reply. But all of it goes through the men for their signature and their review, and then mark it up, send it back if they don't like it. We watch very carefully for personal requests, private letters to the president. We watch about the leadership. We keep track of what each congressman and senator has written in about. We keep a log on as to what he's been interested in, what he asks about, what he's requested. And congressman or senator that hadn't asked for anything very often and would now like the White House to consider this or that candidate of his, we'll give that a little special consideration.
Does the mail, outgoing mail from the congressional liaison, go back to Roland Melling eventually for final mailing?
No. He normally will not see it. We'll occasionally ask him to draft a letter for us, mentioning two or three things, especially if it's a bulk mailing to a lot of all the Republicans in the House or something like that, or all the senators that voted with us on a key issue. I will ask him for a draft, but we do not send things back. They're dispatched by stripping, but go directly from here to the stripping desk.
Mm-hmm.
No further editing. Approved. I usually proof most of the resume before it goes out.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it has gone, been routed to the right person.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular areas? Obviously, this is kind of the clearinghouse for Mr. Timmons. You're going to be involved in just about everything he's doing. But were there any particular areas where you felt you had more of an input onto into the decision-making process?
Well, each of the deputy assistants and special assistants to the president work for Timmons have areas of primary responsibility, like, for instance, Tom Corlogus is primarily involved with DOD or state foreign affairs matters. And if we had something of that nature that came through the office for action, we would route it through him as a minimum, if not through everybody, so everybody would be aware what was going on. I personally, of course, being in the military, had an interest in that. I also came here having done quite a lot of speaking on subjects of international law, which was sort of a secondary area of expertise I developed at the Air Force Academy. And so when papers came through involving our positions on certain aspects of international affairs, I took more of an interest and followed those, and might make a marginal note of Timmons. Usually would say, well, I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other. If you do, go ahead and send it in, which I would do. Military affairs, foreign affairs, I would come in. I also am a nuclear engineer and nuclear physicist, so if something came in of scientific nature or something had to do with nuclear power program, I would follow that a little more closely than usual and comment on it for what it was worth. I can't say that when I did comment that it was ever changed. If Timmons didn't have any strong feeling, I might withdraw it on my own accord. But on the other hand, if I felt that it were something I'll be brought to the attention of whoever drafted the staff action memorandum and include it, and Timmons would usually sign off on it. In the property area I already mentioned, but primarily scientific, international relations, and military affairs were the areas that where I could most closely read, evaluate, comment.
Did you have the extent of daily contact with members of Congress that the other people, who, like Mr. Carlovis or Mr. Friedersdorf, did have daily contact with members of Congress?
No, I would say that each day there would be one or two or three congressmen that would call me about something that they knew I was working on for Mr. Timmons. And usually it was a project or the appointment of an individual, which they'd like to know the status of it. We had one congressman, I remember, that called me and was incessantly about an individual who was being medically retired because of medical disability. And he wanted me to keep track of it, keep him informed on a day-by-day basis. We didn't do anything other than track it. We didn't use any influence, but we did keep him informed. And the congressman would call me directly. Another congressman was concerned about some housing projects in his area. Another one was very interested in some water and sewage projects, and I would get calls because they knew that I was the individual that was tracking these things for Timmons. And if he were tied up, they'd talk to me, and very often I would get the information for Timmons and say, would you like me to call the congressman and brief him on the situation? He would say yes. So I'd establish the contact. But I was talking to them in an information sort of context. If there were an issue on the Hill which involved a vote, usually the people in East Wing would do the talking. And they, of course, talked to 40 or 50 people a day. So my relationship with the Congress was very peripheral and on less political issues. The people here in the East Wing deal with senators and congressmen from the standpoint of providing information, providing arguments in support of the president's legislation or in opposition to a pernicious piece of legislation.
Again, this is kind of overlaps with what you've already said as far as your areas that you concentrated in policy more. But whether departments or other offices in the White House with which you had more contact than with others? Or were there individuals, say, was there one individual on the domestic council with whom you had more frequent contact or more substantive contact?
Well, of course, working for Timmons, you pick up the phone and you ask for anybody. And usually you're asking a question for Timmons, you need a quick answer. And I wouldn't say that there was any individual that I dealt with more than others. In the morning I might pick up the phone and talk to General Scowcroft or Jerry Jones or Dana Mead or Ken Cole or Fred Bizarre, asking questions, getting answers. I didn't deal with executive assistants all that much, which you might think would be the normal way of operating for an assistant, but if Timmons wanted an answer, I usually went right to the individual. If you want to know what the situation was on a disaster or a housing problem, I'd get it from Dana Mead. If there were a military problem, I'd usually go to General Scowcroft. I don't even know who the assistants were in some cases. For instance, domestic counsel, I guess Craig Godston works for Ken Cole and handles a lot of their action that flows through domestic counsel. But I would call the individual. If it were a crime problem, I'd call Jeff Shepard. If a medical problem, I'd call Jim Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. And ask them directly. I dealt with the associate directors and domestic counsel very much. Within the departments, of course, we do deal with the Assistant Secretary of the Department for Legislative Affairs. And those are key individuals. Mm-hmm. And I dealt with them I dealt with them more than any other group of individuals. We would want to find out specifically where a bill was in committee, what the status was, what needed to be done. They would call us and want Timmons to call the Speaker of the House or whatever. We worked very closely with them. Our people, and the way the White House said of coordinating the President's legislative program, so we were sort of more or less singing off one sheet of music.
Did you have an opportunity to attend the morning senior staff meetings?
No. I didn't do that, and when Timmons wasn't around, no one attended. And I think that was, of course, Halderman's and Haig's desire that they not have outsiders. It's not so much that, Timmons had absolute trust in you,
mm-hmm.
but it's not appropriate for him to say, I'm sending Lee Nolan. I want you to have absolute trust in him. Yes, and you all speak freely and so forth. Because they don't know me that well. I think it's implicit that everyone here can be trusted, but I'm not sure they would be as frank in front of a lower level staff officer. And I can appreciate that. Never had any desire to go in there. Those things that are dealt with in the senior staff meeting, but have to be sort of the last crack at tidying things up before they go into the president or giving out the directives, and they have to be precisely correct. And if somebody were to ask me whether I thought we ought to come out, what's Timmons' view? Should we veto this or should we not? That'd be just a call that I would not be prepared to make. I may have known what he thought at 8 o'clock the previous morning, and I know Timmons may or may not have talked to Corologus and Cook and know what the situation is in the Hill and have in his mind an idea of what should be done. But my utility in a meeting like that would be very limited.
Mm-hmm.
I could only tell them what I had overheard. But they wouldn't be asking me, I think, for my opinion. Timmons would occasionally do that. But certainly the senior staff would not. and I would be very hesitant to even offer that until I'd had a chance to check with the other people. Timmons is in a position where it would be, I think, very dangerous for anybody else to speak on his behalf. He knows so much about the way the Hill operates and the real reasons for their request. It's that sort of expertise that's probably why we have Bryce Harlow and Mel Laird here. Timmons' position is so crucial that it's almost impossible for a man to do it all without, you know, taking up his whole life, destroying his family. I don't see how he holds his family together. He works such long hours. Works on Saturdays, works tonight, 8, 9 o'clock. Of course, other people are known for doing that too. A lot of people hope Dr. Kissinger would get married so he would use more reasonable hours. But Bill does work extraordinary hours, and I think if some of the, as long as he continues to handle the operations aspect of congressional relations, and he is, his method of operation is low key and behind the scenes, which I agree with entirely. It's the way my father's always operated in politics, and he's been very effective, and I think that Timmons is right on the button. As far as the method is concerned, he doesn't try to steal the limelight from the president or other senior staff or the congressmen or senators. He's doing a very effective job. But counselors like Harlow and Laird have a prestigious title that means congressmen and senators will talk to them. And it's another sort of an input that the president can have, and it makes the congressmen feel like they're having their back scratched a little more often by a little higher ranking individual. Not higher than Timmons, but higher than if they were talking to some Timmons staff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
of the areas of all that you've mentioned, and not necessarily a policy area, even talking in terms of your comments on military in the White House, are there any particular areas that you would like to talk about in more depth in a future oral history project, keeping in mind too what is well documented in paper files and what is not?
Well, there have been several areas, I guess I'm very interested in. One of them was this volunteer army concept and the draft, the induction authority. I felt very strongly that the president should have requested a simple extension of the induction authority. I think his staff advised him to let the induction authority pass, because it would appear to put him in conflict with his own volunteer army proposal. But I felt that the draft had passed the Senate back when it was much more conservative than it is today by only one vote, when Hitler had already overrun France, Austria, and was invading Poland. If it only passed by one vote after those sorts of horrendous events taking place, I felt like there would never be an opportunity for the draft to be reinstated in time for it to be effective. And that even if the Congress would have not agreed, the President probably still should have recommended that they extend the draft authority so that the Congress would not have an occasion to say, well, it would have been good to have the draft, but of course we received no recommendation from you as to its need, and thereby blaming the president, whoever he might be at the time. I also felt that this this authority could be a standby authority, which sort of like having a fire engine in the firehouse. It would be a clear signal to our potential enemies that the president had a tool that he could use if he needed. And let's say we were to get some sort of crackpot dictator in Russia, a shoe pounder, somebody like Khrushchev that really had people concerned, the president could just quietly start drafting a few people, and it might calm some individuals in other countries around the world down a little bit. Just indicate that the old man means business. When you think about what the president can or cannot do in dealing with the great issues, you think about what his options are. And the more options he has, the better able I think he is of doing the right thing. He has more flexibility. And I think by denying him the draft authority, or by not extending it, we just took away one of his options. So if anyone was interested in my views or my thinking or their efforts that we had in our office on that subject, I'd be happy in a future time to discuss it. I talked to Admiral Moore and to the Deputy Secretary of the Army about this, and we wanted to appeal the decision here. The staff work on that particular thing did not suit us at all. It's one area. Based on what the President saw, I think the decision he made was entirely expected. But I think Bill Timmons' input to it was not sent into the President and presented to him. And I think that the arguments from the Defense Department at the time were not accurately portrayed. The Joint Chiefs of Staff views, for instance, were not incorporated in the staff memorandum. This was during the time that Secretary Richardson was over there. And I felt unfortunate that, well, Dick Cook was leaving at the time, and I was really not of such stature that I could turn it around myself. But I did look into it and make an effort and felt very strongly about it. Of course, I felt very strongly about the Federal Property Council and worked on that. I think Ann Armstrong has a very good counsel with which to do the President's will as far as federal property is concerned. Within the legislative arena, nothing comes particularly to mind. It's very interesting to see the interplay in the White House between the press and the White House, and what sort of things influence Ron Ziegler's office as opposed to what sort of things influence Timmons' office. Timmons tends to come down on decisions based on what he thinks is right and wrong and what he thinks can be accomplished or not. He will recommend that the president do something, and then he may say, but Congress will never pass it. You should be aware of it. Still, I think you ought to speak out in this way. Or I think you ought to veto it, even though there's a possibility the veto would be overridden. The press, on the other hand, or the press office, will more often be concerned about the way the headlines will look and what stories will be in juxtaposition in the Times in the morning. And I've felt on more than one occasion that while it's important to have a good press, that office sometimes had an influence beyond what they should have had, and perhaps affected the president's credibility to some extent, because it put him in a position of saying something that everybody perhaps knew or suspected was not the president's true convictions on the feeling, but something that he felt he had to say at the time because of the politics of the matter. That, of course, has to be weighed. I recognize that now. I also recognize the importance of timing on stories and capturing the Sunday headlines and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, one of the greatest assets that the president has been his credibility, and particularly in the international arena. If he said he was going to do something in Vietnam, my God, he stuck to his guns and did it. He took some hard decisions over there. The bombing, going into Cambodia, these things were very difficult. And he did it and took the heat. So I think foreign governments believe that when the president said he would do this and do that, it influenced them in their action very favorably. I think within the domestic arena, people knew pretty much where he stood. And whenever you, equivocate, whenever you fail to come down on a position, let's say the budget or the economy, if you fail to take a position on a bill, it's a budget buster, which is conforms to your early position. Well, people say, well, it's like the president's going back on his support of the $250 billion budget ceiling. And he seems to be getting in on these things and so forth and so on. This causes instability throughout the country. And I believe that Timmons and working with Congress and having to hold very tightly to the White House position and never give in until the last moment and this sort of thing is more apt to make the decision based on the president's philosophical makeup and his desires, wishes, inclinations on these sorts of problems rather than on how the headlines read. And so I've seen some interesting sorts of conflicts in that area. I guess if somebody asked me about a specific case, I could talk about it. But I'd like to write a book someday about what I've seen, how it came about. It'd be a very peripheral thing as it affected some of the senior staff, but as far as congressional relations and how effective it is, it could be very worthwhile. I don't think any student of government could take 4 years and learn as much as I learned in 1 year within that office. I don't think 4 years of college studying all government courses would let you learn as much about what makes the Congress tick and what makes things go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic experience. I'm about wiped out.
Okay. Let me just ask you one more thing. Where will your files go when you leave?
Well, everything that I'm dealing with here now, I'm turning over to Pat O'Donnell. I'm keeping nothing in the way of a personal file. I tried to not write any memos myself to other people if I could do it with a phone call or stop by personally, let them know.
So your files are not really going to reflect what you have been doing?
No. And I felt as Timmons' executive assistant that, and this is the way I handle phone calls and everything, if I took care of a problem, I said, will you mention Bill Timmons' name when you call the congressman and give him the answer. And whenever possible, I spoke in Timmons' name. For one thing, if I'm doing it for Timmons, it opens a lot more doors.
Mm-hmm.
And the people on the phone talk to me. And so I used his name and strictly acted as his alter ego or whatever as much as I could. Because it did give me the access, it did get things done very quickly because of his stature as being the member of the senior staff. On the other hand, there very often are people not away, and you can put out a little memo and send it over, and it'll get there. And it's not crucial to have it done by phone call. But then again, these things that get left in the files are
in your files are taken out of context. What you did on one day in the heat of the moment, or what you said to somebody, might be entirely different if you read it the next day. So it's awkward to pull those things back or redo them. Not that you don't stand on what you did initially. In our arena, it was so political that I just felt it wouldn't be a great deal of value in my writing memos. Spreading my name around and telling people to do things. I'd write it for tunes, and tunes would initial it if you don't need it, and redo it and send it out. I draft a lot of memos for him.
The files don't show which ones you drafted?
No. There's no, you see, when you work with a memorandum,
you don't
put your little initials down there as to who did it.
Hopefully this is one of the things that eventually a Nick's Oral History Project can go back to some of those things which are more significant.
They might come across things that don't look like Timmons, look like Lehman, and find out that I drafted it almost exclusively. Probably everything is in the Federal Property Council area, since I've been in there, I've handled exclusively most of the things that have to do with the OMB legislative tracking system, the computer. I handled that almost exclusively. Much of the personnel, Timmons would write the initial memo, but the follow-ups I did.
Well, one other thing. You are staying in the military so that any forwarding address could be reached through DOD.
Right. I will leave all that here when I go. And I'll be going to Korea in November. And I'll leave my home wife's home address so that things can get to me, and also in Korea. When I get there, I'll relay my phone number and address back here.
Okay. Well, here is the form which